Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
The UN voted yesterday to investigate possible war crimes in Syria's nearly six-year civil war. Russia, Syria's main ally, voted against it. And yesterday, author John McHugo told us why the connection between Russia and Syria has become so strong over the years.
I'm afraid this was because of a major mistake that the West made. In the 1950s, it was the era of the Cold War. It was also, of course, when the Arab-Israeli conflict was at its height. And basically, the Western powers abandoned Syria. Syria needed arms for its defense. The Western powers refused to sell them.
So Russia stepped in and an alliance was born. Well, today we're taking a look at two men who have ruled Syria for more than 45 years, the late Hafez al-Assad and his son Bashar. David Lesh is a distinguished professor of history at Trinity University. He met regularly with the Syrian president between 2004 and 2009. David, welcome. And you're one of the few Westerners who knows Bashar al-Assad. Are you at all surprised by what's happening in his country?
No, I wasn't shocked when he initiated the harsh crackdown of the protesters early in the uprising in spring 2011, because, you know, over the years, I began to see, you know, this evolution in him, this assimilation into the authoritarian structure over which he presided. From the the unpretentious, unassuming, self-deprecating person that I met early on in his tenure in power, he had begun to change into someone who, surrounded by sycophants, started to see the world through this particular prism that's based in Damascus. You know, again, rather than changing the system that many of us hoped he would do when he came to power, and many Syrians as well, the system changed him.
What was he like personally on a one-on-one basis?
Oh, he was very agreeable. One time I asked him, can you list your achievements thus far? And he said, I'd rather just probably list my failures because they're much more numerous. Many people I've known, diplomats I've known who have met, you know, such, classic dictators of late in the Middle East, such as Muammar Gaddafi and Saddam Hussein, as well as Bashar al-Assad, to a person, they all say Bashar al-Assad was different. You know, he was much more normal, so to speak. Whereas the others, you tended to see the eccentricities or thuggishness, it came through. And that's why I think a lot of people, you know, had hope in the beginning that perhaps he would be different from these other ones.
Well, he had a storyline, a backstory that the West could sort of get behind. He spoke English very well. He was an eye doctor. He had this glamorous British wife. They even paid a PR firm to sort of burnish their image. I mean, do you think that led much of the world to underestimate him?
I think we overestimated him. I think, in fact, it raised the expectations in the West that he would be someone who would engage in political reform in Syria, who would improve relations with Israel and with the West, you know, because he liked the technological toys of the West, because he liked Western music, because he was an ophthalmologist who studied 18 months in London. He's a likable person, and I'm not a psychologist, but, you know, that's maybe the saddest thing about this is, here was this fairly normal, likable person, and he turns into a new Saddam Hussein or Muammar Gaddafi, certainly in the perception of the West. But what most people forget is that, you know, he's a child of the Arab-Israeli war. He's a child of the superpower Cold War, where his country was on the side of the Soviet Union. He's a child of the tumult in Lebanon. And most importantly, he's a child of his father,
exactly.
Hafez al-Assad.
Yeah, let's talk about him, because Hafez al-Assad died in 2000. And the father led the Ba'ath Party, which, just a little background, promoted a secular Arab state inside Syria. The father rose to power in a coup in 1970. What else can you tell us about the father that might help us understand the son?
Well, in fact, Bashar is very much more like his father than the sort of anointed would-be king, Bashar's brother, who died in a car accident in 1994. It was much more flamboyant. I mean, the father was very much of an intellectual, you know, sort of kept to himself and kept out of the spotlight a little bit. And Bashar, although he's engaged in much more public diplomacy than his father ever did, is much more like that in temperament and style. But, you know, I have this thought, I have no evidence for this, but, you know, during the uprising, I kind of have this feeling that at some point, Bashar just had, you know, this moment where he said, you know, my father was right. He knew how to handle this situation like this. And I'm referring, of course, to 1982 when there was a Muslim Brotherhood uprising against his father's regime, and he brutally put down the uprising, the epicenter of it in Hama, with anywhere, you know, around 20 to 30,000 people being killed, and not a peep was heard for a while after that.
And that's, you know, the moment when the father cements his reputation as being the brutal dictator that we know him as today.
Right, yeah, exactly. And, you know, I think a lot of people that were around him at the time made it into Bashar's inner circle in the beginning. And that's kind of the, you know, the modus operandi that defined how the regime under the father, and obviously under the son now, deals with protest and uprising.
What did people expect from Bashar al-Assad when he came to power in 2000?
Well, you know, my first meeting with him in 2004, after the pleasantries and after I told him what I was going to be doing, in interviewing him, you know, I said, you know, Mr. President, the biggest mistake you made upon coming to power is that you said you liked Phil Collins' music, the British rock star. And he kind of looked at me, but what it did is it fed into this emerging image in the West that, you know, he was pro-Western, he was pro-reform, you know, and would do all of these things that the West had wanted, you know, Syria to do for all of these years. But those were misplaced expectations.
Early on, he decided to free or release hundreds of political prisoners that were jailed under his father's regime. But as you say, that didn't last, this sense of reform.
No, and I think there are some who disagree with me on this, but I think he really did intend on trying to engage in more reform than perhaps the system could take. There was private newspapers, unprecedented amount of criticism allowed, private salons opened up and private forums. And basically, after about 6 to 8 months of this sort of thing, some of the regime tough guys, came to him and said, young man, but, you know, you can't do this sort of thing. It's going to undermine the foundation of the regime.
Well, a modern history, I think, is where most people will pick up the story of Bashar al-Assad. Spring of 2011, the Arab Spring was raging across the Middle East. Assad is cracking down on protesters, and outside pressure begins to mount on him. And late that year, Barbara Walters goes to Damascus and does a high-profile interview with Assad. Here it is.
Much of the world regards you as a dictator and a tyrant. What do you say to that?
What's important how the Syrian people look at you, not how you look at yourself. Anyone could have his own opinion, whether president or official or any citizen, the same for me, outside our border.
Public opinion doesn't matter.
Outside Syria?
Outside Syria.
No.
In the context of today, David Lesh, what do you make of those statements from the president?
I think it fits rather perfectly in how Bashar al-Assad and the Syrian regime looks at the rest of the world, you know, that it's been threatening Syria for all these years, long before 2011, going back to the assassination of former Lebanese Prime Minister Rafiq Hariri in 2005, where Syria was blamed for it and isolated. And so this, to them, was just a continuation of an attack against Syria and attempts to try to undermine the regime. Ever since that time. So to them, it was sort of unsurprising in that the Arab Spring that was occurring elsewhere was just an excuse to try to foment trouble inside of Syria without really understanding that, you know, there were, you know, domestic problems and a true indigenous uprising against the failures and frailties of the regime.
But you make this point, this fascinating point, that it could have gone differently, because in March of 2011, Assad made a speech to the country in which he decided to take a defiant approach to the protesters by essentially saying they were supported by terrorists. This speech paves the way for some of the violent methods that Assad will eventually use to crack down on these protesters. And you've written that this was a crossroads because Assad almost made a different speech at the time that would have been much more conciliatory. What happened?
Well, according to my research, and I knew I know a number of insiders who were very close to him regarding the speech that he made on March 30th, 2011, his first publicly to address the uprising. And there were different drafts. And one person I know who was close to him and a friend of his thought that a more conciliatory draft was the one that was going to be the speech he was going to give in front of the Syrian parliament. And he was shocked when he was, you know, seeing it on TV that it was the more harsh one. Mm. And so, you know, one wonders what happened. And you know, speculation is that some in the security apparatus that were close to him basically convinced him that, look, we can put this down in 3 or 4 weeks. You know, you don't want to seem soft, and obviously that was a mistake.
And of course, it led to this terrible civil war that is still going on. The West, as we know, accuses him of using chemical weapons and barrel bombs in that fight, which have killed hundreds, maybe thousands of civilians. The country, David, is essentially in ruins. How does the Bashar al-Assad story end?
Well, I think it ends with him staying in power for the foreseeable future, certainly through the end of his current term in 2021. What will happen then, I don't know. And that's why I would love to meet with him again, because war can change someone. And especially if he survives this, and his sense of triumphalism after this will make him even, you know, more secure and more determined to stay in power.
David Lesh, Distinguished Professor of History at Trinity University and author of Fall of the House of Assad. David, thanks very much for speaking with me.
My pleasure.